Okay, so welcome back. So what we're going to be doing tonight is we're starting a whole new series. This series is going to be running from Shmuel Beis Perek Hey to Yud. So for the 5th to the 10th Perek of Shmuel Beis, and it is entitled The Making of a Monarch. This is where, as we've been learning, rather than just learning pasuk by pasuk or chapter by chapter, we are going through a sort of wholesome series. So this series is about David HaMelech as his rise to power. Up till now, David HaMelech has desisted from taking power. Really, it was all the people around him who were seeking power, trying to get power machinations going. David HaMelech was very much passive in that, except for one action, where he requested his wife Michal back. Other than that, David HaMelech has been rather passive in the whole situation. So we're going to see now David HaMelech make some decisive steps in becoming a ruler. After this, we're going to follow where there's a lot of complication in David HaMelech's kingship. They'll be following from Perek Yud Aleph onwards. But let's start at the very beginning. Tonight, our focus is just what we have to look forward to this evening is, number one, the title of the share tonight is Jerusalem, the Capital, which of course is very important for us today because you can't really appreciate current events unless you actually appreciate history, despite the fact that many would deny our history. But let's appreciate where our history starts. And so we're going to appreciate two events. Number one is what the rest of the tribes of Israel do in response to David HaMelech's kingship. And number two is David HaMelech's attempt to conquer Jerusalem. So here's how we have it. So there's two packets. The one packet is inside the folder is the actual text. That's the psukim that we're going to be going through. The other one is the packet number one of the Mephoshim, which is 3.1, Jerusalem, the capital. So we're going to go through a few psukim, and then we're going to come back to the Mephoshim. Let's start at the beginning. The first little section is very short indeed. It's only Pasuk Aleph to Gimel. And this is what happens afterwards. After what? Basic backgrounds, just to recall for a second. What has happened is that Ish-bosheth, the son of Shaul, the king of really essentially all of Israel except for Yehuda, has been murdered. And David HaMelech has killed the assassinators. These people called Rechavim and Baana, he has killed them. There's no other incumbent. The only other possible person is a person called Mephibosheth, who is the son of Yonatan, and he is not in a state where he's able to assume the kingship right now. And so this is where it is right now. There's a void in power. What happens? So we jump straight into the psukim. Aleph to Gimel, we're told the following: Vayavo kol shiftei Yisrael el David Chevrona. All of Israel come to David, and his seat of power is in Chevron, which is in the south of Israel. Vayamru lemor, and they said, Hinenu atzmocha uvosarcha anachnu. You're our own flesh. You're ourselves. Gam esmol gam shilshon biyos shol melech olenu. Even in the past, when Shaul was our king, atah yisa mhamotzi v'amevi es Yisrael. You were the one who brought. You were the one who brought back all of Israel. Vayomer Hashem locha atah tire es amiv es Yisrael v'atah tiyel lenagid al Yisrael. You will be the shepherd of Israel, you will be the one in charge of Israel. By vocal Ziknei Yisrael and Amelech Chevron, all of the elders of Israel came to Chevron. Before it was the Shiftei Yisrael. It sounds like the populace. Now the leaders follow, which is a funny kind of way of things, right? The leaders should lead, but the leaders follow the populace, and they say Chevron vayichros lahem Amelech David bris beChevron lefrei Hashem, and David makes a covenant with them in front of Hashem. David al Yisrael, and they anoint David as a king of Israel, which happens to be curious because he is already anointed. Shmuel Anavi has already anointed him, but that was almost an eloping, right? Meaning to say, nobody knew about it. It was Shmuel and David in a very quiet, sequestered way, and now this is public. Everybody accepts David as the king. When one looks at these psukim, one has to wonder to oneself how sincere or how flattering these people were. Were they just saying, oh, you know, yesterday we all really, even though we were wearing the Shaul t-shirt, we really, really thought about you, David. Is that really what they were thinking? Or they just need to make sure that their bread is buttered on the right side? Very hard to know over here what the sincerity is. There is a reason why there could be a grain of truth in this, and that is that David HaMelech was yesteryear Shaul HaMelech's general. And we know that David HaMelech, in fact, was a very successful military general, loved by all the troops, all the captains, all the colonels. We know that because on his first mission was to kill Goliath. And everybody started singing his praise as opposed to Shaul HaMelech's praise, which really started get him on a shaky foot. So we do know that David was well beloved. So their comment could be well taken as well, that really we knew you were the powerful one. So there is grounds for their claim, whether or not we don't know it's sincere or not. Dina. Good. And David HaMelech is also his son-in-law and is married to Michal, the daughter of the king. So he is really essentially the crown prince in many ways, not just in terms of ability, but also family. Both matter, sometimes one or the other, depending on which society or place you're in. Nonetheless, David HaMelech seems to have it all going for him, and he recognizes this and is unilateral. You notice, by the way, what a brilliant thing this is. David HaMelech, if David HaMelech had ever reached for power earlier than this, he would have had fighting. David HaMelech never reached for power. The power reached for him. So this is just a profound insight into power. Most people who seek power do not know the secret. Most power people, let's take Macbeth as an example. He has to. He feels it's necessary for him to seize power and to kill those who are stopping him from getting power. As an example, here's a classic example of the corruption of power. David HaMelech is the mirror opposite. He's diametrically opposed. He's not reaching for power, and power surges after him. This is the dynamic that Tanakh is talking about in terms of true leadership. Now, this happens to be that when we learn this section in Shmuel Beis, it happens to be that there's a parallel section in Divrei Hayamim, in Chronicles 1, where around Perek Yud Aleph, around here, which is almost the same story. So it pays, first of all, to look at the parallel story in Divrei Hayamim. And number two is also to see the commentaries there, because they add extra pieces. So here's an example. Rashi, not here, but Rashi on Divrei Hayamim, has a very fascinating idea which he expresses, which is David HaMelech's response. We don't hear too much of David HaMelech's response, except for the fact that he pulls out a covenant, and he signs what sounds like a bilateral covenant, that he's going to be king, and he's going to accept him. Sounds like everything's fine. Rashi tells us in Divrei Hayamim, if you were to take a look at the source packet in Source 1, Rashi says, this is in Perek Yud Aleph Pasuk Beis, he says, Ata tireh esami, the people say to him, you will be the shepherd of my people. So what does he respond? Al zeh omar David, Hashem ro'i lo yachsar. Who is my shepherd? God. Psalm 23. The God is my shepherd, I will not lack. Meaning to say, when David HaMelech is even given the mantle of power, he shifts the mantle of power. He says, it's not really me. Hashem's the shepherd, I'm simply the vehicle. What a profound thing. Who does this sound like, by the way? Who in Tanakh does this sound like? Moshe is one example of a person who also shifts, but Yosef even earlier. When Paro says, Yosef, you sound like a dream interpreter, what does he say? Bilodai, it's not me. Elokim Yaneh Shalom Paro, God's going to answer. So the hallmark of true leaders is that when they need to do something, they do it. But when you ask them to do something, they say, it's not me. Right? Okay, well, this one is what Rashi is doing, is he's paralleling David HaMelech's own words, matching up with the statement they presented to him. So they say, you should be the Ata Tireh, Hashem Ro'i Lo Yachsar. And similarly, Rashi goes on further. That's when things are going well. Shayu Adatosh, here's what he says, going on after that little quotation. Ma ani yochol liros, en adavar toloi bi. Elo Hashem ro'i lo yachsar. It's not me who's the shepherd. Hashem is going to be my shepherd. I will not lack. V'gam ani lo yachsar lochem, and I won't lack for you. V'dugma b'Shmuel, later in Shmuel Beis in Perakov Aleph, Oz nishbu'u anshei David lo leimor, leimor lo yisayt say, oid itonu b'milchama, v'lo sachabe esner Yisrael. Later on, when David HaMelech is getting more elderly, his troops say to him, you shouldn't come out to battle. David HaMelech, you've done your days in the field. You can manage it from your corner office. We'll call you at the end of the day and give you a full report. Right? So he says, and it should never happen that the Ner Yisrael, the light, the lamp of Israel, is extinguished. Meaning you, David HaMelech. What does he say? Omalem David, ki ato ha-neri Hashem, v'Hashem yagia choshchi. Who lights up my darkness, says David? Hashem! Meaning again, when people say, well, David HaMelech, you mean so much to us, well, he says, well, Hashem means so much to me, I'm reflecting or that light rather than being in itself. David HaMelech, and this is very meaningful because it's usually at the end of the career where people are busy, you know, accumulating their resumes and, you know, like all the speaking engagements and all the honorary degrees and all the, you know, all the things that seem to matter to people, right? So at this point in time, he's saying, no, you know, even at the end of his life, he says, Hashem is my light, not me. So this is just an interesting perspective which deepens our appreciation of this. By the way, both of the psukim that Rashi is marshalling over here is what one pasuk is from Tehillim, from his song in Tehillim, which relates to his reaction to this. Another one is his song in Perek Chof Beis. So both of these songs are giving his emotional reaction to this actual event which occurred. Just a very profound way of looking at things. Now let's get to the meat of this particular episode, and that is the capture of Yerushalayim. It is a very curious story we're about to hear. And it has so much depth. It's fascinating. It really, this is scintillating, if you don't mind me saying so, before we get any further. Okay, so ready? Here we go. From Pasuk Aleph, sorry, so we're going now from Pasuk Dalet to Pasuk Yud. This is the next section. So David HaMelech is now king. What's the first thing you would do as king? What's the first thing you would do is stop the horses in Central Park, right? That would be the first. No, oh, sorry. No, we're thinking a little more profound than that. Right, so there are other things that are more pressing when you become king. But there, so what is David HaMelech going to do? See, here's his actions. Ben Shloshim Shana David B'Malchoy Ba'arboim Shana Malach. He was 30 years old when he assumed kingship, and he ruled for 40 years, which means, right, so a majority of his life he spent leading Israel. B'Chevron Malach Al Yehuda. He ruled in Hebron for 7 years and 6 months. And then for 33 years, he ruled over all of Israel. So at this age that he's assuming this mantle, he is 37, right? So that's a pretty young age, right? That's a pretty young age for this kind of responsibility. Nonetheless, he is ra'ui lekach. He is definitely fitting for this job. He went to the Jebusites who live in Jerusalem. And they say to David, they report from the ramparts, and they scream out to him and they say, you can't come here until you remove the Ivrim. What's the Ivrim literally mean? Blind. Pisayach literally means lame. So you can't come here until you remove the blind and lame. You're not going to be able to penetrate Jerusalem. David conquers the ramparts of Zion, of Zion, which is just outside of Jerusalem, which is going to be the city of David, the David citadel. David he says, whoever is able to conquer these Ivrim and Pisrim, these blind and lame people, and to touch the tsinor, which sounds like tsinor literally means a pipe. So if you're able to touch the pipe, al kein yomru iver pisach lo yavoy labayis. That's why he never allowed an iver, a person who was handicapped or pisach, blind or handicapped, to come into the house. Vayesha David v'mitzudah, vayikrola ir David, vayivin David saviv es hamiloi uvayisah. He made his house and his palace there. The God of Israel, the legions of Israel, was with him. So it's a little curious because there's a few just definitionally hard to understand words to understand over here, and also just what is actually going on. So I'd like to explore with you four options. But before we get there, just think to yourselves, before we even get to what is going on, why is it so central to David to conquer Yerushalayim? Why is this such an important first step of his political and his leadership career? What do you think, Tina?
He needs a place to be between.
Okay, so it could be that this is. Okay, good. So we need a capital city. We need a place of political stability. If you just also geographically, he has been in the south. Hebron is to the south. So the south is where Yehuda is. To symbolically be a figurehead, not just in the south, but in the central heartland of the country, Jerusalem, is closer to the heartland than it is to the south, which is just localized to a particular Shevet. And Jesse?
David had made a particular effort to put Hashem in the center of his kingship, more so than kind of any other leader so far. And if Jerusalem is going to be where the Beit HaMikdash is eventually built, even if he's not going to do it, then that's also establishing.
Okay, good. So there's another aspect of it, which is that he knows, it's not by chance that that he's conquering Jerusalem. He has already got information from Shmuel HaNavi that this is going to be the place of the Beis HaMikdash. And at this point, we can see that he really is hopeful to build the Beis HaMikdash at this point in his life. So part of his political leadership is also his spiritual leadership. So he knows that the two have to converge. And if it's going to be the place he builds the Beis HaMikdash, that should be the place of the seat of power. Right, so this is going to be the duality of the Jewish state. It's not going to simply be a political state, not just a homeland, not just a secure place. It's going to be a religious center. So the religious place is going to be the political capital. The Malbim actually addresses this as well in the next source. If you take a look at the next source over here, the Malbim says, "Vayelech haMelech vaAnashav, achar she'ato hitachdu shnei hamamlachot Yisrael." Afterward, now we have unity between the two separate kingdoms in Israel. Shayu ad ato shevet Yehuda tachas David, v'yeser ha'shvatim v'binyamin v'shevet Shaul b'rasham tachas Ishboshes. Up to now, we've had the north under Ishboshes, the south under David. V'shavu kulam l'malchus achas tachas David. Hayamina etzav v'chein ofia b'ratzon Hashem she'ir hamluchot tiyeh b'gvul ha'sheach l'shnei shvatim. So he chose a place which was not one place, not only one tribe centric. He chose which was on the border between Yehuda and Binyamin. Why Yehuda and Binyamin? Because those are the two tribes which had the kings, right? David HaMelech came from Yehuda, Shaul came from Binyamin. So where does he place his capital city? On the border of Yehuda and Binyamin. As a demonstration that this is not about me, it's not about my family, it's not about my tribe, it's about us. That's what the Malbim says. Fantastic. Well, that's true later on. We're going to see that Lo Nischal Chal Shvatim, that Yerushalayim is not divided into tribes. But at this point in time, just from the simplicity of the Pesukim, it seems that we have a unity over here of at least the two presiding tribes. Now, for us to understand this, there's actually one element which is actually missing from our story, which needs to be found in the Direi HaYamim version of the story. So what we're going to do is take a quick look in source 3. This is the Direi HaYamim version of the same story. And it's almost identical, just with one or two extra details. So here we have it in source 3. Vayelech David v'kol Yisrael Yerushalayim, hi Yevus. That's the city of the Jebusites. V'sham ha-Yevusi Yoshvei Ha'aretz. That's where the Jebusites would live. Vayomru Yoshvei Yevus le-David, lo tavo heina. Then the Yevusi said, you cannot come here. Vayukol David es Metzuras Tzion, hi ir David. And he conquered the area around it. The Metzuras Tzion is the area around Jerusalem. Vayomer David, kol makei yivusi barishana yiyeh l'rosh ulasar. David actually puts out a wager, he gives a price. Whoever conquers the Jebusite will be my general. Vayaal barishana Yoav ben Tzruya vayiyeh l'rosh. So who took the leadership was Yoav. It's interesting that Shmuel Beis, the first version, omits this fact. Vayeshev David b'Avatzar al kein karu lo Ir David. He stayed in this area, the surrounded area, and that's why it became called Ir David till today. Vayiven al Ir misaviv min amilo min asaviv v'yav yachayeh shara Ir. And Yoav took the rest of the city. It is interesting because it omits the Ivrim and the Pistchim and the Tzinor in the Direi HaYamim version. It omits all of that, but in the Shmuel Beis version, it omits the Yoav aspect of this. So putting the two together, we get more of a sophisticated perspective of this. So here we go. So the next section over here is just pretty critical. So what actually happens? So let's just understand this. We seem to have, by putting the two stories together, we seem to have that their defense mechanism seems to be maybe psychological of sorts. They're saying they're putting up these Ivrim and Pischim, these blind and these handicapped people on the ramparts. They're saying, you can't hear until you remove us. And David HaMelech makes a wager. He himself doesn't want to do this. He puts up a wager, and Yoav goes and is what seems to be touches the tzinor, touches the pipe. The whole thing seems, what's going on here mechanically, logistically, what's going on over here? Very hard to understand. And Yoav succeeds, and Yoav obviously becomes his sar, becomes his general later on, and this is a successful mission. So let's try to understand this. What I'd like to do with you is to learn four separate approaches to this, and each of them are going to be completely, completely different from one another, as to understanding what goes on here. And they're very profound insights into this episode. The first is that, as quoted in the name of the Ralbag, Rav Levi Ben Gershon, and he says a fascinating thing about what's going on over here. So he actually says that they were very advanced in terms of war mechanics, the Ralbag suggests. Here's how he puts it in source 4. He says, "Vayomer David lemor lo savor hina kafi apshat arevim olai divrei haralbag." So we quote in the Ralbag, "Shebashar ha'ir hayutzalamim b'dmus ivrim upischim." There were these like sort of statues or figurines that were made that looked like ivrim and pischim. "Vayuasuim ba'ofen me'atachbula." So that these automatons would wave spears and swords, iron bars, automatically, in such a violent way that people couldn't get anywhere near them, that they would be hit, they'd be hurt by these iron bars that they were holding, or spears. So it could have been that there were human helpers who were helping them move. So what he's saying is that there is a flow of water, and this water is actually the hydropower which is moving the system, which moves the arms of these automatons, which is stopping anybody entering the city. So they had a very sophisticated water system, like a mill, like a water mill, is extremely powerful and can crush in a water mill grain using just the sheer power of the water which is harnessed. So these figurines were automated through a water power. So what the only way to really, actually, says the Ralbag, really to break the system would be not to get near these automatons, but to stop the water supply, which is what we call the tsinar. So the Ralbag says that David HaMelech is now making a bet. He's putting money on the person who can stop the system. And that's what Yoav ultimately does. Yoav goes in and he's able to stop the water flow. Once you stop the water flow, you've taken away the power. There's no backup generator and you're in. You can now get through the ranks. If this is the case, as Lord Albag is suggesting, other Mephoroshim suggests as well, that just gives you a sense that this is pretty sophisticated warfare. This is like, you know, this is a pretty, you know, we talk about the ethics of drones, you know, where you have an unmanned object which can create damage but not be hurt, right? So if you blow up a drone, you lose money, but you don't lose lives, right? So you say, and there's a lot of ethics which go into that. How can a person sitting in, you know, in San Diego in an office be shooting people in Iraq? And right, well, this is a very early version of this kind of thing over here. So this is why it was particularly difficult to conquer Yerushalayim more than any other places. And we saw earlier places in Tanakh that the Jews struggled to conquer Yerushalayim. Could it be as well because the qualitative military edge was given to the Jebusites up to this point, that David HaMelech was able to stop it. Fantastic. Different way of looking at things. Ralbag, very unique, very, very brilliant insights. But there's an option too. And that is that there is, as famously we know, there's the Chizkiyahu's tunnel, which is what channels into Jerusalem the water from the Silwan, from the valley, the spring in the valley, into Jerusalem, which provides its water source even under siege. Now, what is interesting about this is that in the 1800s, there was a fellow whose name was Charles Warren, who was going through Chizkiyahu's tunnel. Chizkiyahu's tunnel obviously was modified by Chizkiyahu, it existed before him. He was going through this, and it's interesting that he found that at a certain point in the tunnel, this is before it was all nicely lit and, you know, made for tourists, at this point in time, you can imagine it was pretty dark, and he noticed that there was a shaft immediately above him. So he started climbing upwards in this shaft, and it went vertically upwards. And you can actually see on page 3, he has an example of, this is actually sort of a relief of what it is. So there's the Chizkiyahu's tunnel at the bottom, and then there's what's called Warren's shaft. It was named after him when he discovered it. And it goes, if you climb vertically upwards, Then there is a sort of inclined tunnel leading to a scarped and a step tunnel and a vaulted chamber which goes outside the city. So what's going on over here? If you think about this, there's actually a picture on the right. It's hard to see, but if you look down, you can actually see down into the vaulted chamber of Warren's Warren's shaft. You can actually see this, and you can go and see it today. What was David HaMelech really saying? Is he saying the city is too well fortified, so there's no way to penetrate it by making an attack on the actual walls. What was David HaMelech saying? If there's somebody who can find the tzinor, what could the tzinor mean? It doesn't necessarily mean a pipe, but it means who can find a channel into the waterways. What's the help of the waterways? Is the waterways lead directly into the city? What's the advantage of being in the city? Is because once you have an insider, then what would they do? They would open the doors from the inside. So the way in is not to fight on the ramparts, but to have somebody release the doors and allow a direct charge in. So potentially, what some academics have argued, based on the discovery of this Warren's shaft, is that maybe that's exactly what David HaMelech was talking about, is who can discover the waterways. And Yoav was the one who was able to discover these waterways, ultimately get into the city, Trojan horse, so to speak, and let everybody in. Very different way of looking at it over here. It does not necessarily address the Ivrim and Pisachim per se, but it addresses the aspect of the tzinor. That tzinor being something which, this is one of those moments in archaeological discovery which is extremely meaningful, because you have a clear reference to it in the Tanakh, and you have something you can see in the ground, and it's in the right place, it's before and after the ramparts of the city. This makes a lot of sense that this is what David HaMelech was actually saying. Very different way of looking at it, not the Ralbag sort of automated system, but a better way of getting through the siege. Brilliant. Yes, Autumn. No, so that we have as yet to find, but then it is also you're right, we have not found anything of that nature. There are a number of Jebusite idols and inscriptions which we found, but more than that are not. It is interesting, if you take a look, I actually just recently bought this. I bought Josephus, you know, because Rashi and a lot of the Mephoshim, certainly on in later Tanakh, quote Yosifun, which is a summary of Josephus. And Josephus talks about a whole lot of things. Josephus was a colorful and complicated figure who lived at the time, at the end of the time, the second base of Mikdash. And he ultimately converted or pseudo-converted to Christianity. And he wrote a lot of books. And one of the famous books is called Antiquities of the Jews. And the Wars of the Jews. He has a lot of books, and it's very fascinating to read through. So I figured, you know, let's hear what he has to say. We'll start at the very beginning and go through and see what he has to say. So as it happens, he comments retroactively on this. So again, he was not here, right? He was not at this point in time, but this is his version of the parallel to Tanakh. Now, we don't use this as authoritative sourcing, meaning to say Josephus is as much dabbling around in the dark as anybody else is. We have Tanakh, which is the light. But at the same time, it's helpful to think about his interpretation over here. Here's what he says in Source 5. I've sought through this long and wide, and it's very exciting to find this. He says the following. This is in Chapter 3 in Antiquities of the Jews. How David laid siege to Jerusalem and how he had taken the city. He's actually very helpful, because he gives headings to every paragraph. He says he cast the Canaanites out of it and brought the Jews to the inhabit therein. And here's how he goes. Now the Jebusites, who were the inhabitants of Jerusalem, and were by extraction Canaanites, shut their gates and placed the blind and the lame and all their maimed persons upon the wall, in a way of derision of the king, and said that the very lame themselves would hinder his entrance into it. So what are the Ivrim and Pisachim according to the way that Josephus looks at it? They're real people, and why are they putting up their weaker in society? So it sounds like they're using it to deride David, to say, "Ah, David HaMelech, even if we were to have our weakest defending the city, you would never get here. This they did out of contempt of his power, and as depending on the strength of their walls. David was hereby enraged and began the siege of Jerusalem, employed his utmost diligence and alacrity therein, as intending by the taking of the place to demonstrate his power and to intimidate all others that might be of a like evil disposition towards him." So he took the lower city by force, but the citadel held out still, whence it was the king, knowing that the proposal of the dignities and rewards would encourage soldiers of greater actions, promised that he who should first go over the ditches that were beneath the citadel should ascend to the citadel and take it, should have the command of the entire people conferred upon him. And this, by the way, sounds very much like the idea that Sinar being the waterways, right? So they were all ambitious to ascend, and thought no pains too great in order to ascend thither, and out of desire for the chief command. However, Yoav, the son of Tzruiah, prevented the rest, and as soon as he got up to the citadel, cried out to the king and claimed the chief command. So everybody was interested, but Yoav was a little faster and stronger, and he got the command. So his way of looking at this is, again, sounds like a little more like the waterways, but the Ivrim and Piskim sound like real people. Why they're to deride David? There is another way of looking at this. There's another way of looking at this, that perhaps there are real people who are blind and handicapped, but not to deride David, but for a much more nefarious action, and that is human shields. Now, it's an interesting thing to think about this, is would David HaMelech capture the city if it involved a large civilian casualty? It's interesting, that might be an anachronism, because in those days, when you, and up to pretty recently, and in most armies in the world, when you conquer things, you conquer things. It doesn't make a difference who's standing there. You just destroy them. You carpet bomb it. I mean, look what Russia and Syria does. I mean, right now, they don't care about civilians. So it might be an anachronism, but it could also be what they're trying to do is they're trying to play on the natural Jewish values of sympathy, of mercy, of kindness, by putting people over here who might prevent David HaMelech from actually accessing this area, which again provides another depth, another level of the cruelty of these people as well. So not only the derision, but also perhaps working on the weaknesses of David. Yeah. Yes, it sounds like these must be real people. So, and whichever reason that the people are brought here. So this just gives an extra level of sort of like the psychological warfare which is being played over here. So it's not like the Ralbag is saying that it was actually physically hard to enter. It might have been more morally hard to enter this this place, which is why it prevented it being conquered up till now. These are three levels. The Ralbag, perhaps the academic perspective, the Josephus idea over here. But there's another level. And the Radak says the following, Rav David Kimchi. Brilliant, brilliant insight. He quotes the Midrash Chazal. Such a fascinating insight into this episode in Source 6. Umotzana Midrash, I found in the Drash, that's in the Chazal, in the words of our sages. Amru Anshe Yavus La Avraham Kuros Imanu Bris, She'ein Zaracho Yoresh Es Ira Yavus, Vanu Morchim Lecha Es Ma'aras Lamachpela. So he quotes the Midrash that the people of Yavus said to Avraham Avinu, cut for us a covenant, and we will sell you the Ma'aras Lamachpela. That was interesting because, generally speaking, we talk about how Avraham Avinu bought the cave from the people of Ches, the Chittite, which were a different strata of Canaanite society. V'aslo Cain, and they did so. V'anshe Yavus asu tzalmei nechoshes ve'emidum biruchov ha'ir v'kosu aleihem bris hashavuah. And what they did was they made statues of bronze in the city, and they wrote on them the words of this contract. And they were not able to access it because these were the reminders of this oath that Avraham Avinu had made. And up till now, every time that the Jews tried to attempt to conquer Jerusalem, the Jebusites said, sorry, a deal was made not to hurt us. David So he said, you are not able to do this because of this contract. Without going a little further, it is interesting that he goes on to say the following. He says, maybe it wasn't this little side deal which we're not aware of, meaning he's quoting a sort of a deal which we don't see explicitly made unless he's referring to the Chittite, but it doesn't sound like that from the Torah. But there's another version of the Chazal which he goes on to quote, which is that it wasn't Avraham Avinu when buying the land of Ma'aras HaMachpelah, but when Avimelech, the king of the Philistines, who lived in the Gaza area, just before Akedas Yitzhak comes along, and he comes over to Avraham Avinu, makes a contract with Avraham Avinu, and he says, let's make peace between the two of us. And that's where Avraham Avinu actually calls the new city name, which we know today, called Be'er Sheva, the Well of Seven. Why is it called Be'er Sheva? Because the Torah tells us, the end of Perek Chof Aleph, in Sefer Bereishis, that there Avraham Avinu stood seven lambs, and those lambs were as a sign that they were making a Shavua, which obviously relates to the word Sheva, seven oath. And they made a bilateral contract between the two of them. There would be no attrition between the Israelites or the Abramites at this point in time. and the Philistines. Fantastic. But if you look carefully at the words of this contract, when you look at the Torah itself, Avimelech says, "Im tishkor li ulenini ulenechdi." So he says it's going to be for me, my children, and my grandchildren, and my children. Right? It's going to be this is going to be an intergenerational contract. So the other version that the Radak quotes over here is that at this point in time, potentially one of the Philistines was still around. Avimelech's, you know, child of his old age, had a child of his old age, was probably the youngest grandson who was still around this time, many, 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 many years later, and was still there for, as long as I'm around, the contract still holds. So what were the Ivrim and Pischim? So they put up these bronze statues. It wasn't just that they put up bronze statues of anything, but an Iver represents somebody who was blind. Who was blind in Jewish history? Was Yitzhak. And who was Iver? Who was lame? Was Yaakov from this week's parsha by Yishlach, where he has the battle with the angel and is hurt on his thigh, which means what they're saying essentially is you made a 3-generational contract, and your side was that we wouldn't hurt your children and your grandchildren, Yitzchak and Yaakov, and therefore in response you owe it to us not to hurt our children and grandchildren, and the contract's still in motion and it has to hold. By the way, for this to work, you need to assume that the Yevusi, are these Jebusites, are not the Yevusi of the tribes of the 7 nations of Israel, of the land of Canaan, but rather they must be from a Philistine extraction. The Philistines, the Plishtim, are not 1 of 7 nations. They are a seafaring nation from the Cyprus area. So that's why on the coastal plain, and always plagued the coastal plain for Israel. So you must have to assume that some of them was intermingling over here, and Jebusites, don't mean Jebusites as in the Yevusi of the land, but other Yevusi, maybe a person called Yevus, maybe a family called Yevus, who is in the area of Yerushalayim, so the Radak suggests. So now over here, if you're thinking about this is a completely different version of what the Ivrim and Pischim are. This is now the contract which is being held above their head. Now, let's just take this a little further, just to appreciate how deep this goes. So take a look in the next source over here, in source 7, you actually see, these are the psukim in Bereshis Perek Chof Aleph, where Avimelech makes his contract. And if you see, let's actually see where the words of his contract is. Here we are, in the very, very top of page 5, V'atah hishov ali b'elokim heino, swear to me in the name of Hashem, Im tishkor lini, if you're not going to swear, if you're going to deny to me, ulenini, ulenechti, and to my grandchildren, my son, kechezer asher asisim chok ketaseim odimim oretz ashegartobo, you have to do peace with kindness with me and the land that you dwelt in. That's the contract. So he wants it to be this intergenerational contract. You'll notice if you carry on reading this psukim, chav dalet chofei, all the way through to lamed gimel lamed dalet, that's when Avraham Avinu makes his contract, everybody's happy, everybody goes home. What's the next pasuk? The beginning of Perek Chof Bei is the very bottom of these psukim on page 5, after these things Hashem tested Avraham. What's the test? This is like a test where he asked him to sacrifice his son, the Akedah. Now, you may think that these are 2 separate events, but Tanakh seems to indicate that they're not separate events. How do we know that they're not separate events? Not just the fact that they come one after the other, but Tanakh says, Vayehi achar hadvarim o'ele. After these matters, what matters? That Avraham Avinu just made a deal with Avimelech. What happens? There's the Akedah. So the Tanakh seems to be clear in actually juxtaposing these 2 events. But what does the one have to do with another? What does his commitment to Avimelech have anything to do with this hard to understand moment in Jewish history of the Akedah, one of the hardest moments in Avraham Avinu's life? So Rashbam says the most remarkable insight over here, very unknown insight. Rashbam is the grandson of Rashi. He says the following in source 8, "Vayehi dvarim ele, kol makom shenemar achar dvarim ele mechubar el parsha shelamalo." Anytime it says after these things, it is automatically connected to the previous section, skipping the smaller words to about 4 lines in. Afkan achar dvarim shekaras Avram Avinu Avram bris le'Avimelech. Loi ulininoi ulinechtoi shall Avram, but nosun loi sheva kavasa sa sign. After Avram Avinu makes this wonderful covenant with Avimelech, v'chora apoi shall HaKadosh Baruch Hu al zois. Hashem got angry. Why did you make a covenant? Sheharei eretz plishtim bichlal guvul Yisrael, the land of Gaza, which is the land controlled by the Philistines, is the territory of Israel. Hashem says, you need to take full control of the land. You're not going to let anybody stay around you. Hashem made it difficult for him. So he tested Avraham Avinu. He actually made it very difficult for him. Kolomar, at the very top of the next page, Niskayasa b'vin shenasativ lichros bris b'neichem uvein b'neihem, v'ato alech v'aleu lo'ilo, v'yireh ma'ho ilo Christus bris shelcha. You thought you were giving your son security by making an intergenerational covenant that's going to protect him from their neighbors in the future. Isn't this fantastic? And they're going to get a Nobel Peace Prize, and they're going to go to Camp David, and it's going to be a whole big thing. Well, says HaKadosh Baruch Hu, he says, you think you're in control? Well, you know what's going to be is, how do you know you even have him for tomorrow? Take him up to the mountain and kill him. So what's happening over here is a shocking thing. The Akedah, if you think about it, is a response and maybe even a punishment for Avraham Avinu's interaction with Avimelech. Let's think about the power differential for a second. Who needs who in the Avimelech-Avram relationship? Who needs who? Who is successful? Who is the one who's on top? The answer is Avram, which is why the delegation comes to Avraham. Avram is not seeking any peace. He's not seeking security. It's Avimelech who comes to him because he sees Avraham Avinu is immensely successful, which means what we call in halakhic terminology, Yodoy al ha'alyona. He has the upper hand. Therefore, he can dictate terms. But he doesn't dictate terms. He gives him the whole thing. He sells him the whole ship. He says to him, yeah, the terms of the contract are all generations, you know, like the next three generations. HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, why? You need security from him? You think you're going to be all right because of him? But I just told you in the Bris Ben Abasarim that this whole land, west, east, north, south, each way you look, is going to be yours. So what you're doing, making deals that you can't attack certain parts of it. That's not your business. So what happens over here is Avraham Avinu is considered mistaken for this. Let's track this through history for a second, just very, very briefly. Take a look at source 9. Parshas Beshalach, we're going to get there in a few months, in Shmos Perik Yud Gimel. Vayhi Beshalach Paro Esa'om v'lo nechom derech eretz plishtim ki karavu. When Paro sends out the nation of Israel, so let's kind of imagine ourselves in the map of Egypt, right? So he's leaving Egypt, they're moving towards the Sinai Peninsula, right? Which is now Egypt after the peace accord, right? So you're moving through the Sinai Peninsula. What would be the most logical way to get into the land of Israel is through Gaza. Gaza is right along the coast, going straight along the coast from the Sinai Peninsula. You move upwards through Gaza and you're in the land of Israel. But Hashem is not taking the way through the way of Gaza, through the land of the Philistines, right? Ki karavu, because what's karav mean? It is close. Wait a second. That's the reason to take them, right? When do Jews not take shortcuts? I mean, really, right? This is the perfect opportunity. It should be, even though it's close, Hashem didn't take him through Gaza. Why not? So it's interesting. So some of the Mephoshim say, Rashi quotes the Unkelus, that means despite the fact, sometimes the word ki can mean the opposite meaning. Despite the fact that it's close, Hashem wanted them to go around. But the Mechilta, which is what the Midrash over here says, an astonishing fact. The Mechilta says of Rabbi Yishmael, ki korov hu krovo hashavua shenishpa Avraham Avimelech. What is close is the statute of limitations has not been reached yet of the shavua, of the oath between the generations. Shenem avato hishav ali b'elokim heino in tishkolin yilunin l'nechdi v'adayin nechdoi kayom. Avimelech saw his family around. As long as he still has within three generations, they are not allowed to go through the land of the Philistines. Why? Because Avraham Avinu shot himself in the foot by signing a binding arbitration agreement. Right? Avraham Avinu is stuck. So what Hashem is saying is, how could you do this, Avraham Avinu? Now even the way they try to get into the land of Israel is going to be different, is going to be altered because of this. Isn't that remarkable? Ever read Parshas B'Shalach like that? Different way of looking at things. When you get to Sefer Yehoshua, again, Sefer Yehoshua tells us in Source 10, that Israel tried to attack many of the cities, but they could not conquer the inner part of Jerusalem by the Yevusi. Vayeshev Yevusi b'nei Yehuda b'Yerushalayim ad hayom hazeh, and they stayed until today. Until today probably means until before David HaMelech came, depending on who is closing off the sefer, which is, if it's Yehoshua, then it makes sense. If it's a later Navi like Shmuel himself, means probably before David HaMelech gets to this point. Says the Radak once again. The Radak, according to the same perspective. Well, why? Because it's not because that militarily, it wasn't because they weren't good soldiers. It was because they didn't have the right to, because every time they would come closer, they would say, you see these statues, you see these figurines. It's a reminder that, by the way, it's still in effect. So if you think about this, there's almost always this shadow of that terrible episode where Avraham Avinu signed this accord with the Plishtim, which is this shadow which haunts them all their way through until David HaMelech comes along. And David HaMelech, according to the Radak, says that it's too late, sorry, meaning like, this is not what he meant, or that Avimelech's grandkids are no longer here. Whichever way, whether we've met the statutes of limitations, whether it's no longer binding agreement, David HaMelech says, let's get rid of all these statues. This peace accord is null and void, and Jerusalem is open for the harvest. And I think that we see something interesting over here. Shmuel Golden has a really beautiful comment. I'm not going to go through the rest of this right now, but Rav Shmuel Golden says a beautiful point, and that is that you'll notice that up till now Avraham Avinu's life has been outward facing. If you think about it, you know, we talk about a nefesh asher aso b'choron, the impact he had on the world around him. The people of Sodom, Lot, you know, Avraham Avinu is, you know, on the front cover of Time every other month. You know, he is a really powerful and respected individual. From this moment onwards, from the Akedah onwards, in the Yishmael episode, what happens is that Sarah says, you can't let Yishmael stay in our house. And Avraham says, no, he's such a good boy. Sarah says, no, you can't let him stay, and he has to listen to her voice. That moment, argues Rav Golden, was the moment when Avraham Avinu had to turn his focus from the outside to the inside. Because if your house is not focused on, if you don't know what's going on right now inside, then you're going to miss the influences, what's happening, who's saying what, how it's affecting your house. So she says, no, Aaron, we need to focus inwardly. And that's what happens. And when he makes this shvur to focus inwardly, he perhaps even goes too far inwardly, right? He's too protective of Yitzhak over here, which is the danger of what happens. Just to conclude, just to see how powerful this is, the last source we're going to do is source 14, which is the Medrash Rabbah, which says, "Vayikach Avram tzon v'akor v'yitain el Avimelech v'yomar Avimelech l'Avram ma'hen hasheva kavasos." Why these seven lambs for the contract? Amalo Hakadosh Baruch Hu, who Amalo Hakadosh Baruch Hu, aton asat hasheva kavasos b'li ratzani. You gave seven lambs without my consent. Chayecho b'malaf Hashem swears shani meshaheh besimchas bonecho zayin doros. I'm going to give seven generations before you can actually see the redemption. Aton asato zayin kavosas b'li ratzani chayecho sheKeneged Cain horgim bonecho shiva tzadikim v'eluhem chofni pinchas shimshon shaul v'gimel banov. There's going to be seven leaders who are going to be killed before they get to you, because of the seven that you gave Avraham Avinu, and those are the leaders we've seen up till the time of David. Atonas satolai zayin kavasas b'li ratzoni keneged kain bonov machrivim mi bonecha zayin mishkanos v'elohen oil moed v'gilgal nov v'givon v'shiloh u'beis olamim train. So all the different stages and spaces that the Beis Hamikdash, the Mishkan, is going to dwell in are going to be destroyed by some seed of the Philistines who you sought to find peace from. We're going to see just soon that the Aaron is going to go be in exile for 7 months. Why 7 months? In the field of the Plishtim, because that was the amount of time that Aaron Avinu sought to create security. So meaning to say, what this Midrash is saying is that whenever you see that there's a later on problem, it's as a function of over trust in the military alliance, which is just sort of a reframing of our minds. Obviously today we look for security, we look for peace accords, this seems to be what we do. I think we need to attune ourselves a little more to the Tanakh's way of looking at life, and that is that the only protector who's only always going to be here at all times is the Ribbono Shel Olam, is HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and that's the only way, our only source of security. So this gives us a little bit more of a perspective. Next week, Mr. Hashem, we will charge into his final battle of the Plishtim, which is going to be one of the last battles of the Plishtim in this section. In the meantime, have a wonderful and meaningful night.